Good afternoon, everyone. Hello and welcome to this month's e-learning with E2R. I'm Alex, an E2R advisor here, and I'm with Lindsay, and today our topic is going to be progressive discipline. Before we get started, just a few reminders. As always, if you have any questions during the presentation, feel free to use the chat box at the bottom right-hand side of your screen to type them out. We will do our best to answer them during the presentation. If we are unable to answer them, we will make sure to follow up with you after the presentation to schedule a call with one of our advisors. If you've ever missed any of our past webinars, you can find the recordings over on our website, www.e2rsolutionswithanf.com, and the PowerPoint presentations can be found on your member portal. If you don't know how to access your member portal, just reach out to our client care team. They will help you do that. Lastly, we take this opportunity to remind you that the information that we are talking about today is a general overview only and is not intended to be an analysis of all areas of employment and labor law, and accordingly should not be relied upon as legal advice for any situation. As always, please contact us for specific questions related to the information in this webinar or any other topic. Note in your calendars, April 27th will be our next month e-learning, where we will be going through a number of recent employment and labor law cases. We're going to set up the facts for you. We're going to let you be the judge, and then we'll tell you whether you're right or wrong and why. So without further delay, let's get started on today's topic. So progressive discipline. We have our agenda where we're going to outline for you what is progressive discipline. We're going to go through all of that for you. We're also going to explain the purpose behind progressive discipline. We're going to give you some examples of the misconduct that might give rise to progressive discipline. We're going to clearly and fully flesh out the steps of progressive discipline for you. We're going to coach you through how to do an effective disciplinary meeting. We're going to coach you through the documentation you are going to give to the employee following whatever stage of discipline you are at. We're going to walk through some additional case law today as well, kind of highlight the do's and don'ts with progressive discipline. And then we'll go through some general guidelines. Before we get started, a quick note about unionized workplaces. While some of this information that we discussed today is going to be of significant value for unionized employers, it is always important to follow the applicable collective agreement provisions for your workplace and potentially any past practices when it comes to discipline, including any differing kind of progressive disciplinary steps, union representation if that's required, sunset clauses, and whether you can rely upon certain past misconduct, and any arbitrary decisions on particular matters. So just please keep that in mind. So what is progressive discipline? Well, essentially, progressive discipline is an established system where the severity of the consequences increases with each infraction of the workplace rules, policies, procedures, or standards. So essentially, it is a progression. Step one, step two, step three, step four, etc. We're going to build from something that's smaller, typically, to a larger type of form of discipline. So the typical progression, and this is just the typical progression, and we'll get to why that is in a second. It usually starts with a verbal warning. The second stage is a written warning. The third stage may be a suspension with or without pay. There are some important things to understand about suspensions in the non-unionized workplace that we will kind of outline for you shortly. That suspension could also be, instead of a suspension, on like the final warning stage, and then ultimately you are looking at termination likely for cause. Now, progressive discipline should be applied in response to all forms of employee misconduct, and the steps in the progression obviously can be repeated or skipped depending upon the severity of the misconduct in question.
Okay, so now we're going to take you through the purpose of progressive discipline. Why do we bother doing it? And there's essentially six major areas that we've identified that we're going to take you through. So the first being, you know, minor cases of misconduct shouldn't be ignored, right? So most cases of misbehavior or misconduct or deficiencies in performance are not serious enough to warrant summary dismissal or immediate termination. And typically, when that misconduct is relatively minor, then employees should be subject to a system of progressive or corrective discipline so that we can correct the behavior and move forward. Typically, these sort of low-level issues can be avoided when they're dealt with promptly. Now, you know, I'll be honest, we often find that this can sometimes be a challenge because, you know, there are a lot of managers who, you know, don't particularly like having these conversations and discussions with employees when we're having to outline issues of performance or misconduct. But, you know, one of the things that, you know, I always like to remind managers when I'm talking to them is that employees can't read our minds, right? So if we haven't clearly identified our expectations, then having a discussion with employees quickly and promptly to clarify those expectations often can be successful in correcting behavior. So the second one is enforcement of workplace rules. So, you know, certainly progressive discipline can just simply be used to enforce the rules that you've established in your workplace, whether that's the policies outlined in your employee handbook, but also any sort of administrative, operational, or financial policies that you have. So it's a way to enforce those rules you've worked hard to put in place. Another is simply just to change employee behavior. You know, oftentimes we think about progressive discipline as a punishment, and yes, it is. It's consequences for misconduct, but it's also a way to put a stop to unacceptable behavior in an effort to correct the behavior and avoid those issues in the future and create a more successful and productive employee. This sort of leads into the next one, which is employee retention, right? Sometimes, again, we don't think of the positive aspects of progressive discipline, but it can be used actually to retain this employee as a productive member of your team. And I'm sure everyone on the phone listening knows the time and effort and cost in recruiting, right? So retaining an employee is always going to be more economical likely than dismissing an employee and having to recruit, retrain is going to be more costly. So, you know, progressive discipline can be used to enhance your retention rates, and engaging in discipline may inevitably reduce turnover. So a couple of other reasons why we want to engage in progressive discipline, and the purpose, again, is to define our expectations. So the progressive discipline policy is implemented so that there's a clearly understood preset process that everyone is aware of, that's been clearly communicated, that managers and employees are fully aware of with respect to any behavioral or performance deficiencies. So there should be no surprises. Again, employees can't read our minds. So if we want to engage in discipline and define our expectations, then we want to make sure that everybody's on the same page with respect to that preset process. And the last one is that employers are required to deal with matters of employment fairly and in good faith, right? So it is important to apply the principle of fairness when you're instituting progressive discipline in your workplace. And one of the steps that you can take to make sure this is happening, especially if you're having a progressive discipline policy implemented for the first time, is to train your managers, right? Make sure that your managers understand how the progressive discipline policy should be applied. At the end of the day, a system that's perceived as fair is more likely to receive more employee support and understanding. But what that means essentially is that discipline has to be applied consistently to all employees in an unbiased way, right? So we're treating employees fairly, respectfully, and equally. Fair discipline is easier to defend, and this will come up in some of the cases we look at. It's easier to defend and justify to employees and in potential legal situations should the need arise. Judges will look at consistency and how you've applied your own policy. Again, you know, a fairly administered discipline system can improve the efficiency of your team. It can save you time and money. And lastly, union avoidance. So union employees do not always unionize because of money. Oftentimes when employees unionize, it's because they believe that there is preferential treatment going on in the workplace. It's not always money. So again, having this preset process that is applied fairly will definitely go a long way.
Let's talk about some of the types of conduct that's going to give rise to progressive discipline. But before that, I need to kind of admonish myself for a second. I gave you the wrong date for next month's e-learning. It is Wednesday, April 24th, not April 27th. It will not be April 27th, which is a Saturday. It's Wednesday, April 20th.
You don't want to come in on a Saturday, no, Alex, and do an e-learning?
No. Unless there's demand. If there's demand, I will be here. I will talk for an hour. So the first type of misconduct is misconduct. It's when someone is intentionally kind of breaking the rules. So you set important rules for your workplace, and as long as those rules are reasonable, it is expected that your employees will follow those rules. And when someone is made aware of those rules and breaks those rules, that is grounds to give or to issue a disciplinary response. So for example, if you have a particular policy about employee discounts and you only allow the employee to use that for themselves or their family members, and they use that instead for one of their friends, for example, well, they breached the rules, and that would be the basis for some type of disciplinary response. The other type of misconduct or issue that might give rise to a disciplinary response is incompetence. So where an employee lacks or demonstrates a lack of skills or the ability to perform the assigned duties, that might be something that you're going to want to respond to with a disciplinary response. So for example, if you have an employee in your accounting department who makes a number of errors on the financial statements, obviously that's something that we can't allow to continue. And so we're going to want to address that probably with a lesser step first, and we'll get to that, what that looks like in a second, but ultimately you can issue a disciplinary response for that type of misbehavior. The other type would be negligence, so where the employee has the required skills to do something, but they ignore certain duties or they perform their job in a careless manner, that gives rise to a mistake or an issue or a safety violation. So that's the employee knows better, they're not intentionally kind of doing wrong, but they are being very, very careless, and that has then resulted in some type of breach of rules. And so the example there again is the safety check is being skipped to save time. Another type of kind of behavior that might give rise to progressive discipline is when an employee is dishonest. So there's a lot of ways to be dishonest. You can engage in the fraudulent activity. You can lie to your employer as to why you may be late for work, those types of things. And those, again, would be something that gives rise to a disciplinary response. There's two more very common grounds. One would be insubordination. So when you give your employees a directive, it's reasonable, it's expected that they will follow that directive. And when they don't, that's considered insubordination. So that's one of the things that does come up quite frequently in a lot of our calls with our clients, where someone has been told to do something and they refuse to do it. That does give rise to a disciplinary response. And in this case, our example is where a manager gives a very clear deadline to a person regarding the completion of a project, and the employee intentionally fails to do what was asked of them. The last type of misconduct that we're going to talk about today is off-duty misconduct. And so this one is a bit of a tricky one, and we consider doing an actual e-learning on this topic in and of itself. We are going to probably talk about some cases next month about off-duty conduct, because it is coming up a lot more and more with like social media and that type of stuff. But when an employee engages in off-duty conduct that negatively impacts the company and the company's reputation in particular, that might be grounds to issue some type of disciplinary response. Likewise, as the example set out there says, or someone posts some information that is confidential to the company on their website or some kind of other social media site, that would be a breach of both your workplace rules and also off-duty conduct that gives rise to a progressive disciplinary response.
Okay, so now let's move into the steps of progressive discipline. And we're going to start with just a bit of an introduction in terms of a policy. And you know, if you've got an E2R drafted employee handbook, you've got a good progressive discipline policy in there. And it actually, in order to rely on progressive discipline, particularly around unpaid suspensions as a step in the disciplinary process, the law requires an employer, to set out their approach in a well-written and well-communicated policy. So if we've got a progressive discipline policy, we want to make sure that it is well-written and that it is well communicated to employees. Of course, there are certain benefits to having a progressive discipline policy. Obviously, it sets out that progression. It permits the employer to repeat steps, skip steps. It's, again, that preset process that we're clearly communicating to employees that we can then rely on. But it also has a few other benefits. So first, it allows employers to reserve the right to suspend an employee without pay. Generally also permitted as a last resort or a substitution determination, right? We want to make sure that in our policy, we're reserving as a step the right to suspend an employee as a disciplinary action without pay. It can also provide for the remedy of demotion in response to misconduct or performance. So, you know, sometimes you may have an employee who holds certain responsibilities, maybe, you know, the retail sector, a key holder who is underperforming or engages in misconduct. And as part of the disciplinary response, they're actually demoted and those key holder responsibilities are removed. We want to, again, build that into the policy and reserve that right as a remedy in response to misconduct. One of the other benefits of having a progressive discipline policy is that we can clearly set out that the steps of progressive discipline may not be applied to employees within their probationary period. Right? So again, without reserving that right, there's an argument to say that an employer has to follow their policy when it comes to probationary employees as well. And an employee who's in their first 3 months, who's already, you know, engaging in misconduct or, you know, there are performance deficiencies, you know, you're likely just going to want to terminate that employee and cut your losses. Well, we want to make sure that your policy sets out that we don't have to follow our policy when it comes to probationary employees. So all good reasons as to why you want the policy. And now we'll get into and sort of really flesh out the steps. I say that, but I'm going to start with something that is not a step in progressive discipline.
But it's very
not
recommended, though.
It's very exactly. It's very recommended. And I'll talk about why we encourage it as much as possible. But technically, it is not part of the formal progressive discipline track. So we're going to talk about counseling, okay? So counseling is essentially notifying an employee of a performance deficiency or misconduct, but we're not characterizing it as discipline. So even though counseling is not part of the formal progressive discipline track, it is a very important component of good leadership for any managers on the phone. You should be engaging in counseling on a daily basis. Okay? You should be talking to employees if they are getting off track. Again, you know, when we think about laying out our expectations, employees can't read our minds. And I know I've said this a few times now, but you know, there are situations where we think, well, the employee must know that they're doing something wrong. They must know that they can't be late every day. I'm just going to wait and see what happens. Surely they're going to correct themselves. Chances are they won't. Okay, so having these conversations, clarifying expectations is extremely important. And it actually does make it easier to have performance-related conversations because oftentimes in those coaching meetings, when we call it a coaching meeting and not a disciplinary meeting, it's less emotionally charged. So it's easy to have, let's call it a more casual, informal conversation with an employee just to give them a heads up to say, here's what I'm seeing, here's what needs to change, and we expect that you'll do that. But again, not as emotionally charged as a formal disciplinary meeting. Even though it's not part of the, let's call it formal progressive discipline track, we can rely on the coachings to refute any subsequent claims that the employee didn't know, right? So when the employee says, and we get, say, to the formal discipline and we get to the verbal warning or the written warning, the employee can't turn around and say, well, I didn't know, you never told me. And then at least we've got those coachings to say, well, wait a second, we had four discussions with you previously where we did clarify our expectations and told you what you needed to do differently to be successful. That sort of leads us into the next point, right? So even though counseling is not formal discipline, it should be documented. And when we say documented, that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, a formal document written up and put in the employee's file. But as managers, if you're having these counseling sessions, you need to maintain notes of that meeting somewhere. Because we can use it, we can use it for a written discipline later on. And I'm sure any of you on the phone have spoken to us about employee issues. Typically what we'll ask is have you talked to the employee about this before? And if you say yes, we're going to say when.
Where are the documents?
Oh, when.
Where are the documents?
When, how many times, tell us what you said. And I'll be honest, I mean, my memory is not what it used to be. I say that all the time around here. And so, you know, jotting down quickly that you had or shooting a quick email to HR saying, I had a conversation with Lindsay again about being late. This is the third time now. Then we can use those, and we will document those in a written discipline letter that gets to that, to say to the employee, we've talked to you about this. We've told you, and it's disappointing that we've gotten to the point where you haven't corrected your behavior, and so now we have no choice but to engage in discipline. So take notes of those meetings. Have them, but then document them. So a lot of the questions we get is, okay, well, how many counseling sessions do I do until I move to progressive discipline? And unfortunately, there's no magic number. So you can do as many counseling sessions as necessary in any given circumstance. Really, when it comes to this, you're really going to have to use your good judgment and gut feel. We encourage as much counseling as possible. Obviously, you know, it's less formal as the discipline, but you're really going to have to use your gut feel to determine, okay, when it gets to the point where you need to move to formal discipline. And you're going to consider things like length of service, position, previous discipline. You know, if you have a 10-year employee with a previous clean record who all of a sudden is frequently late, then, you know, you're going to treat that a little bit differently than, you know, somebody with 5 months of service. So all that being said, counseling is an excellent way to correct behavior, not technically the first step, but a good component of leadership. So now let's move on to the official first step.
So assuming we've talked to Lindsay already, we've had some coaching sessions with her, and she's just not improving in the area that we need her to improve upon, we're probably going to go to a verbal warning depending upon what her misconduct is. And so we typically use a verbal warning as the first instance, formal instance, to document unsatisfactory performance. It's really intended to notify an employee that improvement is needed in the employee's work performance or behavior. So it's typically used for minor issues, ones that have kind of not been corrected through the coaching process, where you know very confidently that you know that that person does understand what the expectations are and they're simply not meeting those expectations. We're not going to confuse a verbal warning with coaching. So a verbal warning isn't you saying as a manager on the shop floor, hey Joe, you need to stop doing whatever you're doing, that's not safe. Well, that's not going to be a verbal warning. That's typically more a counseling session, albeit a very informal counseling session. We want this to be more of a formalized process, not a casual statement. There are a number of times when I get on the phone with a client and they said, oh, I've told them time and time again that they shouldn't be doing that. Well, what is the context for that? Because that's not going to be a verbal warning. Yes, that would be and that would qualify as a counseling session, perhaps, but not a verbal warning. A verbal warning is going to be more serious. It's going to outline typically what the next kind of stage is going to be if they don't improve. It's a formal process, and even though we call it a verbal warning, you're likely going to summarize your detailed discussion with that individual in a written letter that goes to them and goes into their employee file. Now the second step is typically a written warning. Now, a written warning serves to firmly call attention to the issues at hand. So if there are continued issues after a verbal warning, we're probably going to go to the next step with a written warning. We're going to reference in that written warning that there have been past coaching sessions, that there has been a verbal warning issued on a specific date, and that things are not getting better, and that there are going to be further, more severe consequences if the behavior doesn't get corrected. This should also be kind of captured in a letter. It is a written warning. It's going to go to the employee, and it's also going to go in the employee's personnel file. Again, I would suggest that you have an individual meeting with the individual when you are issuing a written warning. I would probably caution against just kind of flipping a quick email to the employee saying this is your written warning. It is important, and we will get to the kind of like the things you should be doing in advance of like preparing these letters and having these meetings in the next few slides. But it's important to sit down and speak with the person, because they may not necessarily understand that they're doing something wrong. It might be a misunderstanding, so it is a good practice to speak to the person at least before you decide what the discipline should be, and we'll outline that shortly. And then I'll also sit down with them and outline what the expectations are when you're giving them the written warning letter. The third step is the final written warning or the suspension. So the final warning is essentially putting that employee on notice that his or her ongoing issue is not acceptable, and that if they fail to immediately correct the problem, there will be more serious disciplinary consequences, and particularly that their job is in jeopardy and that they will be terminated for cause. At the final warning stage, and the final warning necessarily isn't the third piece of discipline that you give to an individual, there may be a number of written warnings first, especially if the misconduct isn't all the same, et cetera. But once we've gone through the first two steps and we're at the final warning kind of suspension stage, you may decide to issue a suspension with that final warning. Now, we would recommend that if you are going to suspend without pay, that you generally don't do it for longer than 1 to 3 days. We want to avoid the potential for a constructive dismissal claim. Longer suspensions may give rise to a constructive dismissal issue, and that is even if you do have a progressive disciplinary policy that outlines that you are permitted to do suspensions. Quite frankly, in non-unionized work environments, a suspension can be a very tricky thing. You need to have a very clear policy. Ideally, that should be incorporated into the individual's employment contract by reference to your policies, and really I prefer using a suspension as a substitute for a termination for cause, because then we can really stand behind that choice to say, listen, we believe that we have just cause to end our relationship right now. We've gone through the steps, you've received a final warning already. We've decided to save your job because we believe you can improve, and instead we're going to issue you a suspension. The one thing we want to avoid, even though you can repeat steps, if you're going to issue something that is a final warning, we want to be clear that we are following through with our consequences. I've seen a number of times where there are three successive final warnings on file, and that raises some red flags to me as Employment Council, because it looks as though you have really kind of allowed that person to to continue to engage in those issues, and that you don't take it that seriously. And so we want to follow through with our consequences. And one real good way to do that is if there is a final warning and you don't want to jump to termination, is to then issue a suspension, because then at least there is something that is more severe than the final warning. But all of that being said, and all of the red flags that might go along with a suspension in the non-unit context, I've seen very few over my years of practice where a non-unionized employee has actually gone and like fought a suspension or alleged that they were constructively dismissed on the basis of a 1 to 3 day suspension. So keep that in mind. We've gone through everything. We've given all of our final warnings, our suspensions. The behavior is the same, or it's a serious incident that there was no prior discipline, but it's kind of serious in and of itself. We might end up on step 4, which is the termination of the employment relationship. So typically, that's going to be a termination for cause, meaning the employee, through their ongoing misconduct or their one single incident of serious misconduct, has fundamentally breached the employment relationship, and our employment relationship is over. And so that's a very severe step to get to. It's a high threshold. We've kind of talked about that over and over again in all of our seminars, and we will go through a bit of a primer in a second. But that's the fourth step. So the four steps again are verbal warning, written warning, final warning with or without a suspension, and then the employee's eventual termination.
Just before we get into that termination refresher, Alex, there was a question, and I think we have touched on it, but essentially the question was, can major issues, for example, a safety violation, proceed directly to a written warning or dismissal, given that it assumes that the employee has been adequately communicated prior on the safety rules? So can major issues simply just jump to a more severe step?
And I guess, as we noted, you don't have to start at step 1, that you can start at a later step. I'm not overly fussed if we're jumping to a written warning. I would want to know kind of more facts if we're looking at an immediate dismissal for cause. We're going to outline the reasons why that is, but essentially, in a nutshell, we're going to want to look at the context of the whole situation. So how serious was the safety violation? What were the consequences or the potential consequences of that breach? How long has the employee been with us for? What's their disciplinary record like up to that point? All of that stuff. So jumping to the last step, is going to be something that we do need to look at all of the facts involved. But if we're going to jump to the written warning stage and skip the verbal warning stage, as long as we're satisfied that that rule was clearly communicated to the employee and we can prove that they have in fact breached that rule, then I am definitely okay with kind of the starting at the written warning stage, something like that.
Okay. So termination refresher. And we're just going to really touch on this high level because, you know, we've done e-learning just on terminations 101. So, as Alex mentioned, you may get to a point where you are at the fourth step. So, of course, you know, as you know, there are two types of terminations. The first is with cause. So when you terminate an employee with cause, they are not entitled to any notice of termination or severance pay if applicable. This may occur, and I strongly say may occur in the cases of theft, dishonesty, conflict of interest, where there have been allegations of harassment substantiated. So again, where that employment relationship has been broken, where the employee has broken sort of the trust. Poor performance is the last bullet on that list. So poor performance when you've gone through progressive discipline is a very high threshold to meet. So in a perfect world, this would occur when you've communicated your expectations as best you could, Maybe you've given the employee some retraining. You've essentially tried everything in your power to correct the performance issues, but it's simply just not happening. Right, so in a perfect world where we've engaged in progressive discipline, we've dotted every I, we've crossed every T, we've done it in a consistent manner, all of our documents are well written, you would think we would be able to terminate an employee for cause. But we'll tell you, and I'm sure you've heard this from us before, terminating for cause on the basis of performance issues alone is a very high threshold to meet. Of course, anytime you're looking to terminate an employee for cause, you would want to pick up the phone and give us a call, but just sort of keep that in mind. I mean, the alternative is you terminate that employee without cause. They would be entitled to notice of termination, severance pay, common law, whatever is applicable. And that's in the case where, you know, you've done some progressive discipline, or maybe you just come to the realization that you have an employee who is a bad fit or perhaps just a bad hire. Where there is poor performance, but you simply just don't have enough progressive discipline on file to prove that the employee is doing a bad job on purpose, or the performance say is adequate, but you're just simply needing more for that particular role. Of course, you never want to fire an employee on the spot. It may have serious legal consequences. So, you know, anytime you're wanting to terminate, give us a shout. So when you do terminate an employee without cause, they are entitled to notice of termination. You have to meet minimum statutory requirements that are laid out in each jurisdiction. In most jurisdictions, employees are required to have at least 3 months of employment before they're entitled to any notice of termination. And for the most part, most jurisdictions fix the maximum statutory notice amount at 8 weeks. Employers can choose to provide working notice or pay in lieu of notice. And typically, but depending on the circumstances, all forms of compensation and benefits have to continue during that minimum stat notice period. In some jurisdictions also, employees are entitled to statutory severance pay in addition to the notice of termination. And in some jurisdictions, non-unionized employees can seek reinstatement if they believe their termination was unjust. So lastly, of course, subject to an employment contract between you and your employee that limits their entitlement upon termination to just those minimums we spoke of, they may also be entitled to common law reasonable notice. And again, we won't get into this too much in detail, but common law reasonable notice is an art, more of an art than a science, and it's determined by looking at factors such as age, length of service, position, reemployability, inducement. So again, anytime you're at the step of termination, please don't hesitate to pick up the phone and give us a call so that we can walk you through all of this.
So we're going to go back and address that issue a bit more in depth as regards to what steps to kind of start on. So when you're considering what kind of disciplinary response is appropriate, there are a number of factors you're going to want to consider. So the discipline should be responsive to the circumstances. So if we're talking about minor issues, kind of minor first-time issues especially, probably going to start kind of pre-step one at the coaching session kind of stage, or at the verbal warning stage if we're confident that the employee knows what our expectations are. If the employee has committed misconduct ultimately, I guess what we're looking for is that what they have done is going to fit the response. So the punishment must fit the crime. And so we're looking at all of the circumstances, all of have they been trained, how long have they been with us for, have we had this conversation before, et cetera, et cetera. And that kind of leads to another question that we got that spoke to whether or not we need to go through each of the four steps for new types of issues. So for example, say someone is late and they're at the written warning stage. Now they're breaching a company rule that's not related to being at work on time. Well, if the behavior can be kind of characterized as something under the same type of issue, so for example, we have workplace rules and you're not following our workplace rules, you probably can escalate the disciplinary verbal warning for being late, and now you're breaching another workplace rule. So we're going to issue you a written warning for breaching workplace rules, and you're going to want to reference the other verbal warning and that type of thing. So you don't have to go through each step for each individual type of behavior. And again, you can jump right to the end if the behavior itself is very serious. And I know Lindsay talked about those types of things. So when we are considering what type of disciplinary response to begin with, we're going to look at, was the infraction an isolated incident, or is it a pattern of behavior? We have the person who's been with us for 15 years and it's a one-off issue. Well, we're probably going to want to have more of a discussion with that employee, probably result in a written warning depending upon the severity of it. But that person is going to get a little bit more leeway than someone who engages things, not necessarily the same thing, but ongoing issues over and over again. Again, we're going to look at how long that person has been with us. Someone who's been with us for 5 months is going to have less rope than someone who's been with us for 5 years. So we got to keep in mind the length of service that the person has. We're going to also want to explore whether the conduct was intentional. We're going to outline that in one of the cases that we get to. I guess in order to have a severe disciplinary response, it's important that the employee is intentionally engaging in a certain type of misconduct. If someone kind of doesn't know that they're doing something wrong, then maybe a severe punishment like a termination for cause, for example, isn't the most appropriate step to start at. We're going to look at the work history of the individual. How are their issues with ongoing performance reviews? Are they always bad, or is this a new thing? If it's a new thing, we're going to want to look, well, are there extenuating circumstances, and in particular medical circumstances, that might give rise to what is going on? And we had an e-learning, I believe, 2 or 3 months ago about dealing with and mental illness in the workplace and how that can result in performance issues. And essentially, if you have something known as constructive knowledge, meaning you have a good likelihood to believe that there's something else going on that's giving rise to the performance or the misconduct, you as the employer have an obligation to at least ask the question, is there anything we can do to help you here? Or is there anything that you haven't let us know about that's impacting your performance? And if we don't ask those very direct questions, our discipline may not be supportable.
Okay, so we're going to touch briefly on the next couple of slides on the performance improvement plan. So the performance improvement plan, or the PIP, can be used in conjunction with formal discipline, oftentimes when there's many performance-related issues at hand. Right, so the employee is not meeting expectations in several areas, and they've been coached on several occasions. And so the PIP can be used in conjunction with formal discipline. So an employee could be issued a written warning and a performance improvement plan together, or the PIP, more often, is issued as a standalone document that then warns that progressive discipline may occur should there be no improvement. So essentially what a PIP is it's a detailed plan of action that sets out what is expected, what the employee is doing wrong, and how to fix it going forward. Those are typically the three main areas of the PIP. So we want to set out the areas of concern, what's the employee doing wrong, the expected behavior change, what we need you to do differently. The PIP is also going to include components like timeframes. We want to make sure that we're not only in a PIP explaining what the employee needs to do with respect to the expected behavior change, but when we expect to see that change. And that's really going to vary depending on the performance issue. If it's something that can be changed immediately, well, great, that can be our time frame. But if it's something that is going to require maybe some training or a little bit more time for the employee to improve, then we would want to set that out. Again, with respect to the timeframes, we want to make sure that we're always being reasonable and actually giving the employee a real chance to improve and correct. We always recommend as well that the PIP include a section around company support. Again, the idea of the PIP is that we're making this effort to make sure that the employee becomes a successful member of the team. So we want to say to the employee, listen, we're doing this and putting in all this work to have you succeed, and so we're here to support you in this. And so you would want to actually put into the PIP, now the onus should be on the employee to seek out that support, but we want to make sure that the employee knows that it's available to them. We want to make sure in a PIP that we're always outlining when we're going to follow up, right? We don't want to just want to put the PIP out there and let it sit out there and expect the employee to improve. So we want to make sure that we've got timelines in there for follow-up. So to say, employee, we're going to meet with you on a weekly basis to check in on the PIP or whatever, again, makes the most situation. And lastly, we want to make sure it's got a section around consequences. So if we're using the PIP as a standalone document and we haven't gotten to the point of progressive discipline yet, we want to make sure to say to the employee that if things don't improve, we may engage in progressive discipline up to the point of termination of employment for cause. So some benefits of the PIP is that it can be used by an employer as evidence to support a termination for cause, right? So again, it's a documented, detailed action plan that clearly sets out to the employee what the issues are and what they need to do differently. The employee can't say, I didn't know. But to effectively implement that PIP, we need to make sure that the areas of concern are clearly explained, there are clear instructions on how the employee needs to fulfill the expected behavior change, that there are clear and achievable objectives. Again, make sure that we are giving the employee a real chance to improve, give them a reasonable time frame, that there is a clear statement to say that what's going to happen should the employee not improve, i.e. discipline. We want to make sure we're giving the employee ongoing guidance, assistance, support, and the employee can and should be permitted to respond to the PIP if they so choose. Now, all of that being said, the PIP, the process of implementing the PIP and drawing up a PIP will often require substantial time and effort on behalf of an employer, right, and the employee. So, you know, if you are going down the road of a PIP, expect that you are going to be putting in some time and effort. But overall, it can succeed in correcting behavior and performance issues and may avoid getting to the point of discipline and being able to retain, again, a productive member of your team. That's an option to keep in mind.
So one of the things that we mentioned earlier is when you are issuing a disciplinary response, you're likely going to want to have a disciplinary meeting, and it's important that this meeting is conducted properly. So the first thing to keep in mind is that your discipline should be timely. So we want to take steps where misconduct is happening pretty much right away. And the reason why you want to do this is because it's often easier to address the events in question when they have just occurred. As time passes, things get less important. You might not follow through with the discipline. It makes it seem as though the issue isn't that serious. Those types of things. We want to avoid the ability for the employee down the road to say, you have actually allowed my behavior to continue because you didn't address it right away. So if we see some issues that require discipline, we're going to want to address them as soon as possible. That being said, it doesn't mean just jump right into the disciplinary meeting. Always stop and think, what's the appropriate response here? We don't want to issue someone final warning unless we've gone through our contextual analysis and determined that that is the appropriate response. So prior to the disciplinary meeting, you're going to want to review the employee's personnel file and the performance record to get a better sense of how their past performance is. That will enable you to understand whether we're starting at the verbal warning stage or the written warning stage, etc. You also want to see how it was handled in the past. If someone has a written warning for something, we're probably going to want to escalate that disciplinary response, or at least reference the prior discipline in the eventual letter that gets issued to the employee. Oftentimes, we're going to want to meet with the employee before we have the disciplinary meeting. So we're going to want to make sure we have all of our facts straight, that we are confident that they have, in fact, engaged in the oftentimes, we'll have some type of issue where an allegation has been levied against an employee, And we can't just rely upon that allegation. We need to review all of the facts to make sure that that is in fact true. We don't want to issue discipline to an employee who doesn't deserve to be disciplined. We're going to want to make sure that all of our ducks are in a row before we have the actual disciplinary meeting, and that includes meetings with the employee. And so we want to avoid kind of jumping to disciplinary responses without doing these things, because if we do issue discipline and it's unwarranted, it's like I'm the house of cards. So if we're at, we're at step four, but step two and step three kind of weren't supported properly, well, we're not really at step four. And then where we otherwise may have had a termination for cause, we can't rely upon that anymore because our prior discipline wasn't warranted. We're going to make sure in the circumstances that it's all lined up first before we jump to issuing the disciplinary response. And lastly, please keep in mind that all disciplinary meetings should be held in private. And I think Lindsay's going to go through exactly what that disciplinary meeting should be. Oh, no, I'm going to do that. I'm going to do that. Oh, I was just trying to pass the buck here. I'm just passing that fly. So we want to make sure we have an effective disciplinary meeting for a number of reasons. One, I think we lose sight that the goal really for this process is to try to get the employee to be a productive employee. Yes, sometimes we are trying to create some type of paper record to protect ourselves from other issues down the road, but ultimately the goal for this is to really try to correct the behavior and salvage the relationship. You have invested a lot of money and time and all sorts of things in your employees. We want to try to maintain that relationship wherever possible. It's one of the important things is having an effective disciplinary meeting so that the person is informed of the discipline that's being instituted. So we're going to identify the problems and have a discussion with the employee. We're going to seek input from the employee as it relates to why that problem is happening. Maybe there is a lack of training. Maybe they're not getting the appropriate supervision. Maybe there's other issues that are happening outside the workplace that we need to be aware of. So have a conversation with the employee. That might even happen kind of like pre-determination meeting, the disciplinary meeting, like I mentioned, but it might not come up. So I re-raise it again. Is there anything that I need to know that might explain why you can't keep doing it properly? We're going to work through solutions with the employee. So you're doing X wrong. Maybe if you do Y and Z first, then X won't happen. So we want to identify solutions that can help them get to where we need them to get to. That also can include identifying measurable kind of deliverables or goals with the employee. So clearly outline those things. We also want to give them a certain applicable time frame for following up. Sometimes their behavior, like insubordination, isn't something that requires an actual time frame. That's something that needs to immediately change. And so that needs to be communicated to them. Whereas if there is an ongoing issue with their productivity, for example, we might want to give them sufficient time to improve so that our responses are fair. And then we also should give ongoing guidance about whether they are meeting our expectations or not. During that meeting, we're going to want to have another HR person in the room if possible, or someone that is of a managerial capacity. We don't want to have someone, my colleague, in the room with them as a witness. That's not ideal, and that meeting is really not going to be deemed to be a private meeting and really doesn't result in good employee relations. Now, we're also, like I mentioned off the top, ensure we are following our collective agreement. If there is the obligation to have a union rep in the room, then we want to make sure that union rep is there. There also could be some other things that we need to keep in mind. So always look at the collective agreement, make sure you're handling those meetings properly. And lastly, make sure you provide the employee with a copy of the disciplinary letter. They don't necessarily need to sign back the letter. As long as you can prove that they were given a copy of the letter, that should be sufficient in most cases.
And actually, one other question on that, Alex, you just answered it, which was, do you provide employees with copies of letters that document a verbal warning? Yes. Yep. Give the employee a copy. So let's get into the disciplinary letter itself, right? And of course, you know, we dropped a lot of these letters. You know, first and foremost, the discipline should be based on clear workplace rules and standards. So if the employee has breached a policy or a procedure or a rule, then we need to refer to that in the letter. In the case of suspension, you want to make sure that you're describing the conditions of the suspension, when it's to be served, and the fact that it's unpaid. You always want to refer to prior incidents. So if there's previous discipline on file, coachings as well, we want to show the progression that the employee has been made aware of these issues. And we always want to make sure in the letter that it says that if you do not improve, then further discipline may be implemented. That might be further suspension up to and including termination of employment. We always want to make sure we put the employee on notice as to what's going to happen if the behavior persists. Again, going back to our question, the disciplinary letter should be provided to the employee in all instances. There's no reason why they shouldn't get a copy. And as Alex mentioned, contrary to popular belief, and we get this question a lot, the letter does not need to be signed or acknowledged by the employee to confirm that it's valid. And we all sort of have our own opinions as to why you don't necessarily need to have an employee sign that disciplinary letter, but just so you know, the employee doesn't need to sign it. Make sure a copy goes into the personnel file and always seek assistance from HR or E2R with respect to drafting these disciplinary letters, preferably before the disciplinary meeting. It can happen afterwards, but again, and you'll see in the cases, we need to make sure that these disciplinary documents are written well.
So it appears that me and Lindsay really talk a lot and add a lot of value to our seminars, and so we're running up against time. So we have some cases here. The first case is very important, so I'll go through that. The second case, I'll quickly go through because we've already kind of talked about the principles from that, and then we'll get to a bit of the wrap-up because we want to make sure that you're leaving with a high performance. So the first case involved on the termination of a long-term individual. There were several instances of misconduct over several years, which all ended up with one really bad incident, and it's not outlined in that slide, but essentially the person was in charge of making sure the company's materials were sent to a conference in Spain, and those materials and the employer's booth never arrived on time. This was an ongoing problem with this individual, and the employer had enough. They suspended that employee indefinitely and then decided to demote that employee. The employee in turn alleged constructive dismissal, i.e. you unilaterally changed my job without my agreement, and therefore you have effectively ended our relationship. And they argued that the suspension and the demotion was not justified absent an express or implied term in either the contract or the employee handbook. In that case, the court did find that the employee was wrongfully terminated by virtue of the suspension and the demotion and awarded that person reasonable notice. In that case, the employer had a policy on progressive discipline. They did not follow their written policy. That policy did not reference the possibility of suspension or demotion. Ours typically do for that very reason. And so had they followed their own progressive disciplinary policy, they may have been in a better place, but they didn't, and they didn't have the built-in protection, so they were caught in a bad spot. The next case I will briefly summarize. Essentially, we talked about it earlier, we want to carve out the application of progressive discipline to probationary employees. In this case, they brought on someone who had a number of incidences during their probationary period. There was a progressive disciplinary policy which the employer chose not to follow, and they terminated the individual for cause during the probationary period. Now, ordinarily, if they had a good employment contract in place, they would have had a probationary period clause that would allow them to end the relationship without any notice owed, and they would have ousted any additional notice owed under the common law, because there isn't a probationary period recognized under the common law. But in this case, they didn't have that, and they didn't have just cause because they didn't follow the progressive disciplinary policy. And in that case, the employee was awarded 4 months of notice. We now Now, Lindsay's going to briefly talk about where an employer got it right, and then I will wrap it up, and we will be done in a few minutes.
Okay, so this is where the employee got it right. So this is a good news case. So Daly v. DEPCO, the employee was dismissed for cause at the age of 58 after 13 years of service. He was a machine operator. Essentially, prior to that termination for cause, the employer embarked on a campaign of progressive discipline. They had an employee handbook that had a progressive discipline policy. It had a five-step progression that started with counseling and ended with termination. All of the employees were aware of that policy. So over 28 months, DEPCO disciplined Daly through the steps of their policy. There were numerous infractions, everything from performance issues causing major production issues and high cost to the employer, to failing to follow call-in protocol, to showing up to work impaired. So really it ran the gamut. But essentially what the judge looked at is five documented incidences of misconduct over a seven-month period. Those were considered by the court in determining whether the termination for just cause was the correct imposition. So essentially what the court ruled was that DEPCO was in fact justified and dismissed the claim, and the termination for cause was upheld. They basically said what the judge said, and you can see it on the next slide, is that essentially DEPCO followed their own policy and they documented all of the infractions. DEPCO took care to clearly lay out the facts, the penalty if any, and as the employee proceeded through the steps, specific reference was made to the prior warnings given, the dates of those offenses, all of the prior transgressions. So by doing this, the employee, Daly, was clearly reminded of all of the prior warnings and advised at the same time as to what was going to happen if he did it again. And so DEPCO did everything well. They crossed all their T's, dotted all their I's, and drafted great letters.
What are the key takeaways after this hour-long kind of back and forth conversation? So one, it's not there, but what you're going to want to have is a progressive disciplinary policy. First and foremost, have a policy, have a very clear, a clear progression of steps, and then ultimately, and probably preferably, we want to incorporate that policy into the individual's employment contract by referencing the employee handbook being incorporated by reference. We're also going to want to make sure that all of our employees are aware of the workplace policies and procedures. That's the employee handbook. Without kind of setting out the rules and expectations, it's very difficult to engage in a progressive disciplinary kind of process without them knowing the rules that they are breaking. So we make sure we outline what the clear rules are. We're going to want to give our individuals notice that their behavior or issues are actually present, and that we want to make sure they understand what those are. So the handbook, outline the rules. They're not following those rules. We're going to want to have a very casual conversation about that first, outline those expectations. These are the rules, these are reminders, and then jump into progressive discipline where warranted. We want to provide our employees with the opportunity to improve. This isn't meant to be written warning on Monday and then a final warning on Friday. We need to give some time to improve, especially for things that do require some amount of time to get better. We want to include a method of measurement where possible, so our employees know where they stand. We also want to agree on kind of certain follow-up time frames with our individual employees as well, outline the expectations where we're going to follow up, and ongoing guidance throughout the process. And we're going to also very clearly in our letters and our meetings outline what the consequences are going to be next if things don't get better. That's fundamentally important, especially if you want to rely upon termination for cause. Our letters do need to clearly indicate that that is a possibility. And then lastly, and most importantly, we're going to want to document everything. Our counseling sessions, our verbal warnings, et cetera, those documents are going to be fundamental down the road. So document, document, document as always. And I will be talking to you again with another advisor again on April the 24th, not the 27th, Wednesday, April 24th, where we will be talking about recent issues that have arisen in our case law and let you be the judge on those. Thank you very much for joining us today. We're sorry we went over today, but we hope you enjoyed our presentation.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.